Investors Chronicle.
Hello and welcome to another instalment of Lee and the IC, the podcast in which we here at the Investors Chronicle get to pick the mind of one of the UK's most successful and best known personal investors, Lord John Lee. I'm Alex Newman, an associate editor at the Investors Chronicle, with the honour of once again doing the picking here at the Financial Times studios. First, the quick disclaimer that everything we talk about on this podcast is filtered through the thoughts, actions, feelings and experience of one individual. So that means that while our discussion is intended purely as an educational tool, we're often giving one angle in the multitude of views that make up a market. Of course, nothing in this podcast should be taken as financial advice or a recommendation to buy or sell shares. This month, we've got a fair bit to unpack. There's been a big development in the world of UK private investors, the consequences of which I'm keen to get John's thoughts on. We'll also be checking in on the Shares for Schools idea that John's been campaigning for, as well as fielding some reader questions. And with earnings season in full swing, we'll conclude by checking in on some results in John's portfolio and how he intends to use any dividend windfalls coming his way in the coming months. Enough preamble. John, thanks as ever for giving up your time to chat. How are you doing?
My pleasure. Thank you.
So, a fortnight ago, the government used the budget to flesh out proposals for a so-called British ISA. Too much questioning, some derision, some cautious optimism, including on our magazine. This week, John, you wrote, it looks administratively complex, will only benefit the really well off, and unsurprisingly, has hardly delivered a flicker of reaction in markets. Do I take from that you're not resoundingly positive?
I think that would be a fairly sound observation on my comments. Yes, I think it's a damp squib, Okay. Basically. Having said that, I'm a great supporter of ISAs and obviously have done very well from them over the years. I think they're a great wrapper. Also, of course, I'm very supportive of any initiatives and ideas that will stimulate investment in the UK stock market, which obviously is pretty depressed at the present time. But I don't think this particular British ISA, the £5,000 one, actually is the answer and is going to make much difference. And I think it's actually going to overcomplicate things.
What is it about the structure, then, you think it's not really going to deliver?
Well, I think the basic problem is, as far as I can tell, and I think the detail is up for discussion, it would appear to me and others that I've talked to that essentially you're going to have to talk about a separate £5,000 or up to £5,000 British ISA alongside the ISA that hopefully the majority of listeners have already got. That is a hurdle. I wouldn't have thought, the platforms, the Hargreaves Lansdowne, the AJ Bells and what have you, interactive investors will be terribly excited about that. And it just adds another complication in my view. And I think there's a much simpler route, which I'm happy to talk about.
Yeah, just to return to a theme that we've discussed a fair few times on this podcast. I mean, you've said that you think a shift in culture and attitudes is what's really needed for, I suppose, any kind of revolution in private investing in the UK. I mean, that said, incentives, tools, and policies are important, and the things that a government would typically use to try and kick start a cultural change if that's what they want to do. I mean, short of a change in culture, how might else do you think that this or the next government can achieve this broadly stated goal of harnessing the UK stock market to improve domestic investment?
Well, I think there are a number of possible initiatives. One is the idea of the NatWest Shares for Schools, which we can talk about a little later. I'm in favour of British Stock Limited ISA. My suggestion, actually, is that as of now, because I think it would be very difficult to ask people to disinvest overseas holdings from their ISAs. But looking to the future, I think the rules should change, and ISAs in the future, maybe the 20 plus the 5, if we go ahead with that extra 5, should be limited to investment in UK stocks. If people want to invest overseas, and obviously they've done very, very well investing in some of the big American stocks in recent years, I've missed out. Not been an easy 2 or 3 years for me because I'm 100% UK. But I don't see that we should give tax relief or tax incentives, VARA and ISA, to encourage people to invest overseas. And therefore, I would limit ISA in the future to UK equities. And then also, and this has been a big gripe of mine, I would really encourage government to bring in the heads of the television companies and maybe with the regulators and really endeavour to bring about some real significant coverage of UK businesses and UK quoted companies and the stock market in television. So far, there's been near zero contribution or interest from television in the stock market. And I think it's been a big national loss, frankly.
Just sticking with the point on overseas shares exemption, tax exemption within ISAs. I totally take the point, the suggestion. I think you said to me the other day, you can see why it's controversial, given that I suppose it's not just the point about the US stock market having done so well. It's the view now that the ISA is the vehicle towards a diversified portfolio, which many people define as globally diversified. Do you think removing the overseas tax break itself would then incentivize UK share ownership, or it's just going to lead to pushback from people who are in the camp?
Well, I'm not suggesting that those who already have got overseas holdings should divest them, but I think once again it would just increase the focus on UK stock market. I think the efforts that the government is making to encourage pension funds to be far more transparent and to really think much more seriously about investing in the UK stock market and exposing the fact that there's such a small percentage at the moment of many and most pension funds invested in the UK stock market, and not least the parliamentary pension scheme, which has got a very small percentage in the UK stock market. Things like that, I think, would be beneficial.
I suppose the idea that it would be administratively burdensome, I suppose, kind of applies to the British ISA as currently touted. So, I mean, obviously you have, certain global equity investment trusts where how do we categorise those? But it's a question to be worked out, I suppose. And
yes,
maybe it's a point of fairness.
Yes, our details. Yeah. But I mean, my fundamental point is, yes, we want to encourage ISAs. And of course, now, they are regarded as wonderful tax-free wrapper. And my sort of foreign friends are very, very envious of the wrapper and the advantage we have here. But I think it's a very fair question. Should we be giving tax incentives to allow people or to encourage people to invest overseas? It really is as simple as that.
Do you think, as some have argued, that what's needed as part of all this reform, potentially, of ISA, is one, simplification, and two, to kind of change the marketing of and emphasise its tax-free status? I mean, individual savings account is a bit dry and vague in some ways, don't you think? I mean, you've lived through the PEP era. You've seen how the branding has shifted over the years. Do you think there's an argument for a new change?
I don't think so. I mean, I think amongst those who've got resource and got cash, I think there's been a huge acceptance of ISAs and a big growth. And of course, last weekend's press and no doubt the coming weekend as we approach, the tax year end, we'll have big supplements on ISAs. But there are other things that can help. For example, the junior ISA that can be taken out for young people. And I've done that through my daughter. I'm not allowed as a grandparent to take out a junior ISA for my grandchildren. No, they say, only a parent can do that. So one can do it, but one has to give the money to your own child to do it for the grandchildren. That something like that, for example. I mean, why prohibit the grandparent from starting and encouraging a grandchild on the road of investment in a direct way? Things can be made easier.
Yeah, indeed. So Professor Nigel Savage, who's a listener and a seasoned small cap investor like yourself, got in touch to say that he is a bit put off by another element of the tax treatment of ISAs, and that's specifically around the inheritance tax that is applied to ISA accounts, which still fall under inheritance tax in many instances, though with some notable exceptions, some AIM-listed shares have business relief status. I mean, his feeling is that the IHT-managed ISA portfolios come with high charges and fees, but that actually navigating all of this is really complicated for a private investor because there's no clear list or guidance on which shares qualify for IHT. How do you navigate all of this, John, if at all, or is it just not? Is it a consideration if you're looking at an AIM-listed share whether it qualifies?
Well, I take it into account. I mean, I think it's an interesting point. I think fundamentally, one could actually make an ISA up to a certain level free of inheritance tax. Full stop.
Yeah.
And you know, that also would be an encouragement, once again, provided you're investing in British stocks. That would be a plus and a boost to ISAs if they were overall free of inheritance tax. At the present time, it is rather messy in that within an ISA, it is the AIM stocks and only approved AIM stocks that carry at the moment inheritance tax relief held for 2 years, I think I'm right in saying. And of course, we're not helped by the fact that the Inland Revenue will not say which AIM shares are exempt and which aren't.
Yeah.
I mean, why they're reluctant or incapable of doing that, I really don't know. I mean, that makes life much more difficult. But I've got a number of AIM shares in my portfolio, but companies that you know, stand up to my normal tests, as it were, and satisfy the normal criteria that one looks for in investment. But then additionally, one has hopefully has the inheritance tax relief as well. So once again, you know, this whole area could be given a boost.
Is that something, just in terms of the practicality, you would check with your broker when you're...
there is no authoritative list or guide.
Really? Okay.
So you can talk to a broker about it and you can talk to individual companies and some of them say, you know, we believe we are or we regard ourselves as being, you know, a qualifying company for IHT purposes. But, you know, there is no guarantee because there is no approved list. And, you know, I think this is just, another absurdity, frankly.
Incidentally, the idea that a British ISA could contain an element of inheritance tax exemption up to a defined limit or threshold is an idea that Professor Savage has also floated. So I think he's with you on that one.
Good.
So the British ISA hasn't been the only interface with the Treasury you've had in recent weeks. John, there's also been a bit more movement in your idea to include secondary schools in the proposed public sale of NatWest shares. Can you just briefly, one, I suppose, remind listeners of the idea? And then two, what feedback you've had and where things are at now.
Sure. The idea basically came to me 2 or 3 months ago in the context of becoming increasingly aware that the government were considering disposing of the remainder of their NatWest holding via the TelSID route, in other words, involving the members of the public. It occurred to me that what would be marvellous and transformative would be if government considered giving a small quantity of the NatWest shares as a gift to all our state secondary schools, because I think it's common ground that financial awareness in our state schools, indeed all schools, is really very, very limited indeed. And so our youngsters are being turned out with very little knowledge of what a bank is, what the stock market is, and what a dividend is. And so my idea would be that the government gifted, say, £5,000 to each secondary school to be held for the long term if the schools wanted it. It wouldn't be compulsory. And at the current time, £5,000 for the NatWest shares would deliver a dividend of about £350. And this really is the key thing, that the decision on how to spend that £350 would rest with the pupils. So they would decide by way of vote. That would be up to the school to organise, presumably the senior levels of youngsters. And they would decide, so they could decide, for example, to buy an item for, you know, for the school laboratory or for the school, to subsidise a school trip, to support a local charity, a local food bank, or and consider even reinvesting that £350 dividend. But the key point is they would be empowered for the first time. Then also, clearly, because the school would own the shares, they could attend by Zoom the NatWest AGM. And I would suggest that NatWest would be very willing to send, you know, senior people in to talk to the schools about the bank and how it operates. And then if we could get this off the ground, then I believe we should try and encourage regional public companies to donate a small number of shares, maybe £1,000 worth of shares, to say the half a dozen state secondary schools in their locality where their employees' children go to school and where they recruit from, or will recruit from. And this would build a real bridge between those companies in the locality and the youngsters, which would be a plus. And it would be giving the youngsters an increased awareness and financial knowledge. Now, this is a unique opportunity. This is the key point, really. It only arises because the government's got the NatWest shares and is planning, as far as we know, to go down this Telsid route. Mm-hmm. So it's an opportunity that will never come again. And the total cost, with just over 4,000 state secondary schools, would be about £22 million, which really is a drop in the ocean, considering the government's got about £15 billion worth of NatWest shares that it needs to sell. So this is an idea that I have to tell you, everyone, both inside Parliament and outside, that I've talked to about it, thinks it's a great idea. And we've written to the Chancellor, and I've had meetings with the Schools Minister, and with the Economic Secretary of the Treasury to explain it in more detail. The media are now coming on board to support the idea. And if listeners like the idea and, could think about maybe writing to their MP or writing letters to the paper, you know, that would be hugely appreciated. But it is a unique opportunity of really, for the first time, beginning to seriously raise financial awareness. And when we realise also that more of our young people now speculate in cryptocurrencies than actually invest in a traditional form, we should all be actually quite concerned and rather ashamed of that.
There was some suggestion, I think, that the share sale may take place in June. I mean, I don't think any of the details on the NatWest disposal have been fully announced or fleshed out. But I expect we'll probably get more information on all of this in the coming weeks. I noted that, Hargreaves Lansdown put out a piece on the website suggesting that retail offers can often take place at short notice and then happen very quickly. Have you ever participated in the past in? I mean, I know we had Royal Mail a few years ago.
We had a whole number. I mean, I remember when I was in Parliament, we had a whole number of privatisations. And indeed, my favourite questions in any stock market quiz is to say to people, if you'd invested in all the government privatisations of the Thatcher era, which would have done the best?
Right.
And no one, I have to tell you, no one has got the correct answer.
Okay. Don't ask.
You know, they say water or gas or British Airways, but the answer is Associated British Ports.
Okay.
Which has been by far the most successful privatisation in financial terms, ultimately taken over by the Australians. I think it was Macquarie who bought it, so it's no longer a public company. They were a great success. I can't remember whether I ever personally applied for any of the privatisations. I did have a few Associated British Ports very early on, a very small quantity that I sold, sadly. Much too soon. But obviously, if the NatWest shares do come on offer, I think they could be quite attractive because the yield at the moment is about 7%. They would have to be offered as a discount to the market, so therefore the yield probably would be, 7.5% to 8%. You know, very big bank. I think most of the banks are, pretty well run these days and pretty well capitalised. I would have thought could be successful. And, you know, I'm sorry that some of the commentators are a little bit lukewarm towards the concept.
Well, let's watch this space. It'll be interesting to see the NatWest share sale play out, but even more so with this campaign as well, and see how that goes, John. So we often talk on this podcast, I suppose, on a fairly high level about investing, but as we've discussed, practicalities matter a great deal too. So I was really pleased, actually, to receive a few questions on the nuts and bolts of your own portfolio management, John. One comes from Andrew Jefford, who wants to know if you use stop losses, which I think for anyone unfamiliar with how these work, it's if the share price of a company you hold drops below a certain level, there is an automatic sale placed to sort of safeguard against very steep falls. Andrew writes that, as anyone who has invested in small caps will know, that the market reacts brutally to bad news and bad narratives, and it's not uncommon for the investment gains of years to be wiped out in a few sessions on negative sentiment. So, that's the question I suppose he's putting. Do you manage your portfolio in that way, or you have limits and orders?
No, by and large, no. I haven't really operated with stop losses over the years. I think if one was going to bring one in, I think you have to be talking about a 20% stop loss. In other words, if something you buy has gone down 20%, then maybe. But frankly, in the small cap arena, which is my prime focus, movements can be very, very lumpy. And only a small volume trade, and so one can get sort of, you know, 5-10% swings very, very easily both ways. So I tend not to worry too much about stop losses if I believe in the fundamentals of the business. Although I have to say, it probably would be a fair criticism of me to say that I have been probably too loyal to too many companies for too long. But there we are. I hold my hands up to that. I am essentially a long-term investor. I'm certainly not a trader.
But it's an important point, I suppose, even for traders. It cuts both ways, doesn't it? When liquidity is short, then you might be selling at a point which, you know, prior to a recovery then.
Yeah, so. Well, I think that's right. I think the more interesting question, frankly, and the one that is the most difficult to answer is about selling when you've made a good profit. I've suffered over the last 2 or 3 years because, you know, a number of my holdings which were very highly rated, like Treat, like Ampario, like Lock and Store, you know, have been substantially derated. And one's seen, you know, quite a negative reaction in their share prices. Maybe they were somewhat overcooked originally, but probably they've fallen somewhat too far now, as it were.
Yeah.
So it's not easy to know when to take a profit. Maybe to consider top slicing. You know, it's a very difficult judgment, I think.
Yeah, there you go.
I've certainly not solved it anyway, put it that way.
There you go. After 6 years of investing, perfect hindsight still gnaws away.
No one gets everything right, I can assure you.
So Andrew and another listener whose name I've misplaced also wondered how you monitor prices, get your information, etc. So how do you, you know, on a day-to-day basis, how are you checking in on your portfolio?
Well, I have my my portfolio on my iPad, so I can, you know, I can pretty well check movements. Usually I log in around 7 o'clock in the morning, checking any company results and any announcements. I enjoy doing that anyway. And at the end of the day, most days, stockbroker that I use they send me a printout of my portfolio with any day's movements clearly shown. So I you know, keep in touch on a daily basis and indeed during the day, focusing on one or two particularly large holdings to see what's happening there. Not that I'm looking to trade or take action necessarily. But you know, it's part of my life and I enjoy it.
Yeah.
And if you don't enjoy it, you're not interested in it, then best leave it to someone else to manage your portfolio, to go through a fund. But I actually enjoy investing in individual companies, as you know. and following their fortunes.
Another listener, David Winterbottom, is keen to know what you use, I suppose, by way of potentially software tools or otherwise to generate investment ideas. Do you use any software, or is it, you know, just more a general approach of what you read?
It's more a question of reading, you know, then maybe digging into a particular company, you know, its website and its RNS statements. You know, obviously I read the City Columns, I read the Investor Chronicle, obviously, you know, Financial Times, particularly at the weekends. Then I'm a member of a sort of little breakfast investment group and a lunch investment group and a dinner investment group, where ideas are exchanged. Thankfully, they don't all fall on the same day. Otherwise, I would be somewhat...
Too many ideas,
somewhat,
too many meals.
Somewhat obese, yes. And occasionally, you know, one or two interesting thoughts come up there that I follow up and check. But because obviously I've been investing for a long, long time, I'm pretty well aware of you know, all existing companies that have been around for a good few years. I don't find it easy to monitor, you know, some of the newer companies that come along, and I do miss out on that area. But I don't use any sophisticated software, as it were. I'm a little bit more of a, you know, a broad brush man.
For sure. David, it appears, is also a long-time fan, and noting that it's been about a decade since you published How to Make a Million Slowly, which was your, I suppose, your kind of career in investing. Wondering whether you're considering writing a sequel. Is that something on the cards?
I muse about it from time to time, but no present present plans. I did produce, of course, you know, a book two or three years ago called Yummy Yogurt, a first taste of stock market investment, which was focused really on beginners. Very short, simple read, only a 30-odd pages to try and give the basics of investment. And of course, I'm still writing my quarterly Financial Times column in FT Money. And, you know, the next one comes out, I think, around the 23rd of this month.
Yeah. Well, it's the 21st of March as we're recording now. So I think by the time listeners hear this, they will be able to read that already. We've typically avoided on this podcast making very sort of short-term commentaries or responding on a week-to-week basis on, you know, looking at companies and markets. But I thought we might make an exception for two of your companies in this episode because they've just reported. Starting with the AIM-listed Anpario, which is the ticker ANP, which published its full-year results yesterday. I believe, you know, it's one of the few holdings we haven't actually talked about much here. Could you sort of briefly sketch out what it does and your background as a shareholder, and then maybe we can sort of dig into the results?
Yes, it's a very nice, attractive little company that I've been a shareholder in for quite a few years now. And it has been successful. It was very successful and was much more highly rated. And the rating, as with the number, has come down in recent years. But it really ticks, for me, it really ticks all the boxes. The business essentially provides stimulants, natural stimulants, for animal growth. Additives, in other words, for food, for feed, for poultry and pigs, and there's an aquaculture involvement for fish as well and other animals. These are natural additives, and of course there is a big move away from chemicals and toxic additives. So you know they're really in the right place, doing all the right things environmentally, as it were, and from a health point of view. It's a mini global business. They sell their product from their plant in a workshop all over the world. I visited the plant some years ago, and they have a foothold in a number of countries. In recent years, some have done better than others. So you know the record's been a little on the patchy side recently. But of course, as the world population grows, people become more affluent, broad brush, then really, you know, demand for food increases, for quality food increases, and Paro should benefit. And it's very conservatively run. They've always managed to keep a nice a fund of liquidity and pay a I think they've paid an increasing dividend every year they've been public for the last, you know, 15 years or so, maybe longer, 15, 20 years. Again, marginally increased it in the results very recently. And the report that came out on their results, I think, pointed to a resumption of growth. I think they're very nicely positioned to move forward. And also, of course, like a number of my smaller stocks, very vulnerable to a predator who takes advantage of a more modest rating.
Yeah. Just to dive into the results in a bit more detail, a few headline highlights. The gross margins were up. They cited improved cash generation. Like you said, the increased dividend. But at the same time, I think it looked like they've had a bit of a trickier end market because sales were down, pre-tax profits down a quarter. And the chairman said that meat protein producers around the world, obviously, as you alluded to, Amparo's main customers there, saw quite a lot of margin pressure, higher competition, lower consumption, which hurt demand for, I suppose, their specialist additive products. I suppose the sound from yesterday seemed to be that they are now more efficient because of this difficult patch and that markets are improving. Is this, in your mind, a kind of a cyclical business?
I wouldn't say it's a cyclical business, but I would say and acknowledge, you are absolutely right. I mean, they've had a difficult 12 months, obviously, with inflation. There was also, and this is true of so many industries, there was a lot of destocking, which obviously affected them. And then, of course, the significant rise in shipping costs, transportation costs, as we know. So, it's not been easy. It's not been an easy period for the majority of normal trading sectors, as distinct from the high-tech arena. But I think that, they do have an attractive, interesting future from a very solid base.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they returned, 10 million or so to shareholders, and their cash position is almost back up by that figure now. So it's a very nice little one to have tucked away, and I'm sure it will deliver over time.
Yeah, it's a fair point as well. I mean, I suppose, we talk about growth stocks and growth stories. I mean, even within a growth story, you're going to have elements of cyclicality or ebbs and flows, I suppose, within an end market or a customer base. So, drawing these kind of style distinctions is not always very useful.
Sure.
A couple of UK businesses servicing similar end markets have had a tough time of late. One is Genus, which is the genetics group, which has been struggling a bit. Another I noticed was Benchmark Holdings, which effectively put itself up for sale in January after deciding it was sort of materially undervalued. I mean, you talked about, potential price action. Similarly, that I think you wrote in your article this year, it's about as easy to anticipate a takeover as it is to spot the next salmon when you're fishing.
Yes, but I do think the article that I've written for the FT, which actually I think is on their web now, even though it comes out a little later, is really headlined, the year of the takeover, and we've already seen. Haven't we? And it's only just, we're just in really into 2024. We've seen a whole list of, of names, Currys and Matterley Woods.
Wincanton,
Wincanton at 100% premium. Who would have thought, Wincanton would have warranted 100% premium? So I think inevitably, as interest rates come down, and therefore, there is a greater opportunity for private equity firms to take on debt. They will be seizing and are seizing the opportunities in an underrated and lowly rated UK stock market. And that's why I think we'll see a lot of action during the year. Over my 6 years of investment life, I think I've seen pretty well or been on the receiving end of a takeover or a take private virtually every year. So I've been on the receiving end of about 60 of those. The last one a couple of years ago with Air Partner. So we'll see what 2024 brings. But I'd be surprised if none of my stocks were bid for over the next 9 months or so.
Yeah. Today we also had for you numbers from M&G, ticker MNG, which we spoke about at length in our first episode, and which I believe is your biggest holding.
Is certainly my biggest holding.
What were your initial reactions to the numbers?
Well, I only really sort of top lined them as yeah. it were, and read the basics, but. Overall, the figures seem to be good. The growth in a number of areas of activity, a reduction in the cost base. New people have been brought in to head up the different divisions. And there was an optimistic vein throughout the statement, I thought, which augurs well. The dividend was very fractionally increased, but then it was already a high payout anyway. I think when I was buying the shares, they were on about a 10% yield. We've gone up somewhat now, but the dividend yield is still about 8%. So for a company of that size, I think, you know, that is a very attractive yield, particularly, of course, in an ISA where it's tax-free. And so, you know, I've had very positive announcements on the dividend front in the last few weeks from you know, my big holdings in this sector, like Legal & General and Aviva and, as you say, M&G. And all sort of tax-free within an ISA, you know, I think these are incredible opportunities and in income sense balance some of the smaller cap stocks where the dividend payout is and the dividend yield is lower. But to have a block of these at the present time in your ISA tax-free, I think is a great opportunity.
Yeah, and we can maybe come on to your potential use of those dividends and also comparisons within the sector. Just to stay with, for a moment more, the results as they were for M&G. I mean, everything looks pretty positive. At the same time, you know, this is quite a complex, multifaceted business, maybe getting more complex because unlike a lot of their peers, they are, you know, they're thinking about international growth. Unlike some peers, they also appear to have identified lots and lots of sources of growth, rather than hunkering down.
Sure.
Do you think this sort of complexity around the business and maybe the interest rate sensitivity, you know, of their capital and balance sheet, means that the market is always just going to apply a bit of a discount?
I think certainly it's been a somewhat misunderstood stock because of the mix essentially of asset and wealth management and also a growing annuity business, as it were. But certainly having talked myself some time ago to, you know, Andrea Rossi, the new chief executive, he believes having that mix is a great strength and, you know, gives them a real growth opportunity when maybe the traditional investment management sector is under more pressure. So he sees it as a plus, and I think the market will increasingly see it as a plus. But I agree, it is a slightly more complex business. Also, of course, in terms of, you know, potential takeovers, and they are mooted, have been from time to time, it doesn't make a potential takeover of a company the size of M&G any easier because of the different activities it's in. There's not one predator, as it were, who would be the ideal person to take all sections over. You probably need some sort of partnership approach if that ever happened. But I'm not looking necessarily for a takeover of M&G. I'm very happy with the dividend yield payout, as it were, and the prospects of growth from the business.
Just 2 points in there. I mean, like you said, I think since we first spoke about them in episode one, they're up about fifths. So, you know, showing it's not just been an income story. There has been some capital growth as well. That pushes them slightly out of your golden 7-7 ratio. Does that change the equation for you? Or they're still undervalued relative to LNG and Aviva and Phoenix and others?
Yes, so. I think there's still a degree of undervaluation. So I don't think they're fully valued by any means. I mean, they yield 8% at the moment. My view is that probably, given their strength and optimism, I would have thought they should be on a 6% yield rather than an 8% yield. So I think theoretically there is that price movement upwards to bring that yield down, and hopefully we will begin to see that as more people you know, recognise the near certainty of dividend, at least maintenance, yep, and probably gentle growth.
That dividend, from the final dividend at least, is going to be paid on the 9th of May. You talked about the other dividends that you've got coming into your portfolio from other big insurer holdings. A little way out, but were you to use it today, would you be putting it back into M&G or other large holdings, or are you looking to recycle it elsewhere?
You know, I think that I may take a little out for sort of personal expenditure.
Sure.
Maybe one or two tax bills where, you know, I've taken profits in stocks outside my ISA and where one does have to pay capital gains tax. But certainly there'll be some reinvestment. I think I'll be tending to top up a number of smaller holdings that I've got where I think there is considerable undervaluation. You know, I feel that I'm now pretty heavily represented in this grouping of Aviva Legal and General M&G, which generate this great dividend, tax-free dividend income. So I think I'd be looking to top up some of my smaller holdings and maybe open one or two new, one or two new areas of investment as well.
Okay, we'll be interested to find out what those prove to be in the weeks ahead. Lots to explore again, as ever, on our next episode, which of course includes any questions you'd like to put to John, which you can do by emailing me at alex.newman@ft.com. Until then, all that's left for me to say is to thank you for listening. Thank you, John, as ever, for your thoughts.
Thank you.
And time. And to thank our producer, Maddie Apthorpe, for all her work behind the soundboard. Until next time.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.